You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's an acronym for a group of industrial chemicals known as per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. They've been used, these PFAS, since the 1950s, and everything from firefighting foam to fast food paper wrappers to stain-resistant textiles and carpeting, waterproof shoes and boots, nonstick pots and pans. You get the idea. A lot of products. Studies have shown PFAS to be linked to various health problems, including a higher risk of some cancers. The chemicals have been found in groundwater in 29 sites in 14 communities around our state. And it seems the more the state DEQ looks, the more contamination it finds. But getting firm answers on how much PFAS exposure is dangerous and how you best clean it up, that's been harder to nail down. Let's get the scientist's take on PFAS as we welcome Tom Bruton. He's with the Green Science Policy Institute in California, and he's written about the need to coordinate health research in PFAS-contaminated communities across the United States. Tom, any idea just how many Americans have been exposed to PFAS?
We do have an idea, and it depends on what level of exposure we're talking about, but the number is in the millions. So a study that we did a couple of years ago estimated, based on the best EPA data that we have, that something like 6 million Americans are served by water supplies that contain levels of PFAS at concentrations higher than what EPA says is safe.
Okay, and just so we all are clear, where are the major sources of these chemicals?
Well, one of the big sources actually is the use of a specific kind of firefighting foam that's used to put out liquid fuel fires, so the types of fires that you might have where a plane crashes or where fuel is stored. And so the military, civilian airports, chemical plants, they all use this type of firefighting foam. And a lot of them had training exercises where they would spray this firefighting foam and practice putting out fires. And over time, the foam that contained these PFAS chemicals leached into groundwater. So that's one of the big sources. Another source is industrial facilities where the chemicals were either made or where they were used for other things. One example that's timely right now is the Wolverine Worldwide Tannery there in Michigan, where a PFAS chemical called PFOS was used for waterproofing leather.
Yes, exactly. And that certainly has made a lot of headlines and caused a great deal of concern in our state. And are these chemicals still being used today? So are we opening ourselves up to exposure by buying certain products, for instance?
Uh-huh. That's a good question. And the chemicals that we know the most about, that the harm is the most clear for, have largely been phased out by manufacturers in U.S. and Europe, while they're still made in China. In their place, manufacturers have started using some closely related chemicals. They don't stick around in our body as long. They're not bioaccumulative, and so they're thought to be less risky, but they still share many of the same chemical characteristics. They still are very persistent in the environment, and many scientists are concerned that these new supposedly safer alternatives might not be as safe as the chemical industry likes to say.
So if we've known, Tom, that these class of chemicals can be harmful to humans, it just seems that sense of what is safe or acceptable is fuzzy. So what do you say to people who have been told, yes, the water in your well has a level of PFAS?
Right. Well, it's always difficult for scientists and physicians to say to someone who's been exposed to a certain level of contaminants, because of that exposure, you are going to experience such and such a health effect. That's just not the way that science allows us to talk. What we can say is that based on large population level studies, we know that exposure to these chemicals does increase the likelihood of various adverse health effects, including the ones that you listed off at the beginning of the segment. So it's hard to pinpoint what is going to happen to any one individual, but we know that on the large scale population basis, exposure to these chemicals does increase the risk of health effects.
Tom, shifting to the cleanup side, what have we learned from other older contaminated sites around the country about what cleanup methods work best with PFAS?
Sure. Well, PFAS, because they're extremely stable chemicals, they just don't break down in the environment hardly at all. They're more difficult to clean up than other types of contaminants. You know, ideally, when you're dealing with a a contaminated site. Say, you can imagine an aquifer underground is sort of like a cup of Coke, and that all the liquid in that cup of Coke is contaminated. You'd like to clean it all up. For other types of contaminants, we have, for instance, bacteria that we can use to clean up all the contaminated groundwater, because those bacteria can break down the contaminants. That doesn't work with PFAS because they're so stable, they're so strong. Instead, all we can do is basically filter out the Coke that's coming out of the straw that you have into this cup. So any well that's pulling up water that's contaminated with PFAS, we can filter that water, but we're not really taking care of the problem. We're going to have to keep filtering that water for as long as we want to use it. So they're quite challenging from the remediation perspective.
As we've gathered from our conversation, PFAS are so widely used across so many industries. Tom, how is the conflict between commercial interests? Here's something that is so useful in so many products, great waterproofing, great, you know, fill in the blank, how many uses. So conflict between commercial interests and public health concerns, how has that influenced our ability to really get a more sophisticated understanding of just how harmful these chemicals are to people and to our environment?
It's a really good question, because like you said, these chemicals are so uniquely useful. They're used in many different applications. But at the same time, we've known for a while, and there's an increasing body of evidence showing that these chemicals, you know, certain of them at least, are quite harmful, and care needs to be taken when they're used. And I think it puts an onus on us to really consider when these chemicals are needed. And are we using them for applications that are critical, where there's nothing else that will work? Or are we using them just because it's easy and they're familiar and we haven't researched potential alternatives that are out there? One example I'll use is that we talk to the outdoor industry, who uses a lot of these chemicals to make really great weatherproof jackets. And while I think it's true that if you're going out mountaineering, say you're climbing Mount Everest, you probably want apparel that's waterproof and is really the best that you can get. On the other hand, you don't need waterproofing chemicals in your surf shorts, and these types of chemicals are being used in applications like that. So I think just some critical thinking about when they ought to be used could really help us reduce these public health problems down the line.
PFAS contamination has been linked to military bases, as you indicated. Certainly the now-defunct Wirt Smith Air Force Base in Oscoda, the Grayling National Guard Training Base, here have been issues here in Michigan. Do you have any information on just how the military is dealing with what it left behind?
The military has actually been fairly proactive in trying to get out ahead of this problem. They realized some years ago that their liability for cleaning up PFAS was going to be quite high. They're the largest user of this AFFF firefighting foam that contains PFAS, and so the estimated number of sites around the country where they may be having to do some sort of cleanup response is in the hundreds. And so they've actually been investing a lot in academic research to come up with new ways of treating PFAS. I think as of the end of 2016, they've spent $200 million testing water supplies at the different bases. And they're budgeting up to $2 billion over the coming decades to fully deal with PFO and PFAS cleanups at their different installations.
Can you put Michigan's response to our PFAS problems in context? How do we compare with other states?
Well, I think the formation of the recent, you know, cross-state committee to deal with PFAS is promising. It indicates that there's a lot of attention being paid to this now up to the highest levels, and so that's, it looks like Michigan is taking a proactive stance. At the same time, there are some states that I'd say are a little further out ahead on the curve. For instance, New Jersey has been aware of the high prevalence of PFAS in their water supplies for more than a decade now, and so they've had scientists within their state government thinking about PFAS, doing risk assessment, and proposing safer limits. And they've actually proposed maximum contaminant levels for several of these contaminants that are much lower than what EPA says is safe. At the same time, I think that Michigan is ahead of other states. I think there are probably a number of states where PFAS is going to become an issue, but it hasn't yet, and that's largely because, for whatever reason, no one has gone out and looked for PFAS. Clearly, in Michigan, you know that it's there, and so that allows you to start working on the problem, which is good.
Yeah, and that's your proposal to coordinate health research in communities across the country dealing with PFAS. What do scientists like you need to help us? What should people be demanding of their elected leaders?
Well, one of the big issues is a lack of data. Because these contaminants are not regulated under the Safe Drinking Water Act, like many water contaminants, utilities are not required to test for them. And so it's hard to know where they are, at what levels, and so it's hard to know where they might be a problem. If there was more mandated monitoring for these chemicals, then scientists and state officials would be able to do a better job prioritizing, how to spend their resources to protect public health. But I also think that increased funding to EPA, to the National Institutes of Environmental Health Science, to the CDC, to the agencies that are in charge of dealing with this problem, would allow them to put more focus on it and get out front of things and think about how they could best come up with a coordinated response, come up with an action plan for the country so that individual states don't have to keep reinventing the wheel and sort of scratching their heads every time a new state discovers this problem and sees that there's not a lot of clear federal guidance on what to do.
Tom Bruton is a scientist with the Green Science Policy Institute in California. Tom, thank you so much for spending time and talking with us on Stateside.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.